Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in today's broadcast, sharing with you a visit to Stoner in search of Edmund Campion. And our popular Latin lover takes apart the glorious Latin of Paul VI, to the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Michael Ramsey. Well, thanks very much for joining me once again. It's easy to forget English Catholics were once persecuted. That's unless you happen to come from a family more or less like mine, once referred to as recusant. Or again, if you happen to live next to places where the memory of martyrs to the faith still lingers on. Places like Stoner, which I once visited on an outing when I was still a convent school girl in a blue uniform and stripy tie. And where, together with my chums, I remember being struck not only by the deer park and the magnificent house we saw there, but also fascinated by the tales told there of priests being hunted and going into hiding in secret rooms under floorboards or behind walls or fireplaces. Priests like Edmund Campion. A Jesuit martyr, my colleague, Jill Bevilacqua, once went in search of, precisely, at Stoner. Be sure to stay tuned.
Stoner. Now, that's a name which probably means nothing to most people. But it is, and will always be, a holy place. For there, one of the greatest of our English martyrs, Edmund Campion, stayed on more than one occasion. And there he revised the proofs of his Decem Rationes, 10 Reasons for Being a Catholic, a book of some 20,000 words written to provoke dispute on behalf of the faith. Campion was born in 1540, the year Ignatius Loyola founded the Society of Jesus. But he grew up in a turbulent time. Henry VIII had broken with Rome and declared himself head of the church in England. There followed the brief reign of Edward VI, a time of extreme Protestantism. And then came Mary Tudor, who returned the country to full Roman obedience. And as one writer puts it,
"Now Elizabeth and her counsellors seem to be erecting a new church to occupy the middle ground between these two extremes."
A brilliant Oxford scholar, Campion had taken the oath of royal supremacy, and as a fellow of the college, was expected to proceed to ordination in the Church of England. He only got as far as the diaconate, for as time went on, he became more and more uneasy about his religious position. Finally, he fled to the continent, where he studied for the priesthood in Douay and was received in Rome as a member of the Jesuit order. After several years of pastoral work in Prague, Campion was chosen, among others, to go to England to minister to the distressed and bewildered Catholics at home. It was 1580. Elizabeth I had been excommunicated 10 years previously, and the position of Catholics in England was growing more and more difficult. With fellow Jesuit Robert Persons as his superior, Campion set out on his mission, the purpose of which was described thus: for the preservation and augmentation of the faith of the Catholics in England. After a brief stay in London, consulting with other priests, the two men decided to separate and visit different parts of the country. Warning them that they were in daily danger of arrest, Thomas Pound, a Catholic layman, suggested they compile a statement of their purpose in coming to England, which could be made public in the event of their capture. Otherwise, he said, the government would be able to publish any account it chose of the nature of their mission. The two agreed, and Campion's statement, in the form of a letter to the Privy Council, was so eloquent that Pound, we read, could not resist making copies and spreading them around. It became known as Campion's Brag. As Evelyn Waugh writes,
"It was composed in great haste, when the saddlebags were already packed and the horses waiting to take Campion on his journey. It is the work of half an hour. The expense is reckoned. The enterprise is begun. It is of God. It cannot be withstood. So the faith was planted. So it must be restored.
For several months, Campion and Persons travelled about the country, moving rapidly from house to house, and everywhere bringing courage and hope, and best of all, the Mass and the sacraments. But as printed attacks against them became more frequent, it was clear that they would have to answer them. In his book on Campion, Evelyn Waugh writes of the great need of the Catholic Party for a printing press, and of the problems they encountered.
The difficulties were formidable. Every transaction, even the purchase of paper, was fraught with danger.
It was agreed that Campion would write a defence of Catholicism in Latin, aimed at the universities. By Easter, his book was completed. Persons, meanwhile, set up a press of a kind, first in London and then at Stoner Park, near Henley, in Oxfordshire. The change of residence for the press became necessary when a stationer turned informer. You never knew who might be spying for the authorities. Persons' lodgings were raided, and one of his workmen arrested and racked, without success, to make him reveal the hiding place of the press. London was getting too hot for comfort, and as Waugh writes...
In these circumstances, Parsons removed to Henley, where Dame Cecilia Stoner put her house at his disposal. It was well suited for the purpose, being hidden in woods and easily accessible by river from London and Oxford. Here, the Decem Rationes was printed.
And here Campion came to revise the proofs. The choice of Stoner was not casual. Its remote, private position made it an ideal refuge for hunted priests, and in this case for the printing of pamphlets and books. The house is set amid the dense beech forests of the Chiltern Hills. As the family guidebook states,
Stoner is hidden in a fold of the Chilterns, 5 miles from the Thames at Henley. The park grows out of the surrounding beechwoods and fields, enhancing and emphasising the dramatic shape of the hill slopes.
And in fact, the hill rising behind the house offers the possibility of a dramatic getaway for any fugitive. Campion did not have to flee from Stoner. He was apprehended later at Lyford Grange, further away to the west, in Berkshire. And Stoner? It's been the home of the same family for 800 years, and as the guidebook states proudly, a centre for recusancy since the 1580s. Campion, we recall, was martyred in 1581. Recusancy is a refusal to accept or obey established authority. But, as a modern dictionary comments,
it specifically meant the refusal of Roman Catholics to attend services of the Church of England, which was a statutory offence from 1570 until 1791.
A note in the guidebook about Dame Cecilia Stoner is illuminating.
Dame Cecily Stoner was the most remarkable of the recusant Stoners. In 1577, her annual fine for recusancy was set at the modern equivalent of £50,000. In 1581, her son John, who guided the missionary Father Edmund Campion and his colleague Robert Persons about the Catholic houses of the country, was taken prisoner when Campion's printing press was seized at Stoner. She was herself much imprisoned and frequently entreated by the Privy Council to conform. But even as an old lady, with estates gone but for Stoner itself, close relations executed, banished or imprisoned, she remained stubbornly recusant, and what is more, continued to harbour priests wherever possible.
The chapel at Stoner, we're told, is one of only three in England where Mass has been celebrated without a break. In penal times, this would have been a highly dangerous activity. Saying or hearing Mass meant a fine of £100 and a year's imprisonment. A fine of £20 a month was imposed for not attending the Anglican Church. £100 was the fine for a convicted recusant if found within 10 miles of London. On one of my visits to Stoner, I came across this declaration of Dame Cecily Stoner to the justices at Oxford. I had a copy of it framed, and it hangs over my bookcase as a constant reminder of the testimony of a woman of unshakable faith.
I was born in such a time when Holy Mass was in great reverence, and was brought up in the same faith. In King Edward's time, this reverence was neglected and reproved by such as governed. In Queen Mary's it was restored with much applause, and now, in this time, it pleaseth the state to question them as they now do me, who continue in this Catholic profession. The state would have the several changes, which I have seen with mine eyes, good and laudable. Whether it can be so, I refer to your lordship's consideration. I hold me still that wherein I was born and bred, and find nothing taught in it but great virtue and sanctity, and so, by the grace of God, I will live and die in it.
For those who enjoy visiting historic houses, there's plenty to see at Stona. Apart from the house itself, rich in period furniture, pictures and objets d'art, there's the 14th century chapel of flint and stone with a brick tower, the library where you can find an important collection of Catholic books, many of them illegally printed or imported for Catholics in England during penal times. And there's the deer park and the terraced hillside gardens. But I'd come to Stona on pilgrimage. I was not interested in a collection of furniture. I was looking for Campion. And so I climbed the flight of narrow stairs leading to the Campion room. When you go to Stona, this is the one corner of the house you may not miss. It is, for me, the holy place. It's in the roof. Here, the family guide, you may read.
In the gable over the main door is a room known as Mount Pleasant. Edmund Campion, the Jesuit martyr, and his companions, Robert Persons, Stephen Brinkley, and others, used the space behind the chimney in this room as a hiding place and for the secret printing of books. Decem Rationes was distributed in Oxford in June 1581 and caused the furore which led to Campion's capture, his trial for treason, and his execution in December. There was a raid on Stoner and several people were arrested, including John Stoner and his mother, Dame Cecily Stoner. The printing press and much massing stuff were seized.
I reached the top of the stairs and entered the room. But what I was looking for was that alcove under the roof, that space behind the chimney where the printing press had been kept. And there it was. But a fire extinguisher barred the way, suggesting that visitors were not expected to violate this area. But I was not going to give up now. That afternoon there was no one around, and it was a matter of seconds to cross over into the Holy of Holies, where Campion had stood, or rather crouched, for you cannot stand upright. Here they had printed his 10 reasons, and here he had peered at the meagre apparatus, as Waugh puts it, of the precious press, and carefully read through the proofs of his work, always on the qui vive for sudden discovery. There was no lack of priest hunters. The reward for the simple apprehension of a priest was £100. 400 years and more have passed, and the atmosphere of penal time seems unreal, part of a fantasy. Only it was not a fantasy, but a harsh reality. Between 1559 and 1722, over 20 penal laws were passed, whereby we read,
it was sought to cripple and render incapable of action the Catholics of Great Britain and Ireland, and if possible, to get rid of their religion in those countries.
It was thanks to men like Campion and women like Cecily Stoner that the attempt to eradicate the old faith entirely was doomed to failure. When Pope Paul VI canonised Campion and the other English martyrs in the October of 1970, he welcomed representatives of the Anglican Church, for he saw it as an ecumenical occasion, full of hope, as he said.
For the future reunion of the separated members of the one mystical body of Christ, in the knowledge that we have in heaven such allies and representatives of the cause of union and peace among all Christians.
Campion himself, in his letter to the Privy Council, had ended with these words.
I have no more to say, but to recommend your case and mine to Almighty God, the Searcher of Heaven, who sent us His grace and set us at accord before the day of payment, to the end we may at last be friends in heaven, when all injuries shall be forgotten.
Warm thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for so generously sharing with us her moving visit to Stoner, and indeed for shining the spotlight on the Jesuit martyr Edmund Campion, whose feast day falls on the 1st of December. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, time for our weekly rendezvous with Father Reginald Foster, better known as our popular Latin lover, to whom I publicly apologise. Why, you may wonder? Well, simply because at a moment when he had plenty of other things to do, I bullied him to come in to translate an address of Pope Paul VI to the Archbishop of Canterbury, Michael Ramsay. The date was the 23rd of March, 1966, the place, the Sistine Chapel, and the language, well, Latin, of course. Just listen. Can you remember the meeting between Paul VI and Archbishop Ramsay?
I do remember those things.
On this occasion, the Archbishop of Canterbury spoke in English, but Pope Paul VI spoke in Latin, which he had a very peculiar brand of Latin, no?
Well, I mean, of his secretaries. '66, I wasn't there, of course.
They met in the Sistine Chapel, right? How do you say Sistine Chapel in Latin?
Sacellum or Sacellum Sixtinum.
Why Sacellum?
Is it like a small sanctuary, chapel? That's what we say, Sacellum Sistinum.
Sixtinum or Sistinum?
Sixtinum, XY.
Because I have the speech in Latin. And do you want to listen to it at all? He says, the world looks on, and he says, mundus aspicit historia.
Aspicit.
Mundus aspicit historia memorabit.
The world looks on, history will remember or recall.
Renovas quidem egregium illud humanitatis officium.
You repeat, indeed, that outstanding sign of goodness.
Quod accessor tuus illustris et honorabilis, Godefridus Fischer, desideratissimum decessorem nostrum felicis recordationis Ioannem vigesimum tertium est prosecutus.
By which your predecessor, the illustrious and honorable Gottfried Fischer, got it?
It's Jeffrey Fischer.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you say Godfrey, you say Jeffrey, okay. Accompanied our most longed-for predecessor of happy memory, John the 23rd.
Id agens quasi reficis pontem, abing non nulla saecula recissum.
Doing this, you, as it were, remake the bridge, cut down many centuries ago.
Quae ecclesia romana et cantuariensis inter se erant coniuncte.
By which the Roman Church and the Church of Canterbury had been joined among themselves. That makes sense as you're following there?
I'm following, not in English, I'm following in Italian. Because
oh,
I
don't
find
care.
An English text.
Pontem dicimus.
Pontem dicimus. We're talking about this bridge.
Quo vincula reverentiae, bone estimationis, et caritatis significantur.
By the way, these are glorious words. We are talking about the bridge by which the bonds of reverence, of good esteem, and charity are designated.
Why are they so special, these words?
I mean, the whole idea is out of this world. If we just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's up to that point.
Mm-hmm. And then I tried to pick, for our listeners, I tried to highlight some of the points that I find particularly significant or I find particularly poetic. For example, the next paragraph.
Te non in domum extraneam ingredi, set in domum quam semper vigente titulo etiam tuam potes appellare.
You should feel that you are entering not a foreign house, but into a house which you are always able to call even your own, vigente titulo, with a flourishing title.
Gaudemus ianum tibi aperire.
We are happy to open the door for you.
What is the door?
Ianuam.
Ianuam.
Janitor.
That's where janitor comes from.
Well, certainly. What do you expect?
Et cum ea animum pandere nostrum.
The doors of our heart.
Well, okay. And with that door, to expand our own spirit.
Let amor enim et honore officimur.
Hey, this is out of this world. And honore ad hanc temporis opportunitatem verba sancti Pauli transferences, secundum quae te accipimus. We are happy, and we are filled with honor. Transferring to this opportunity of time, the words of St. Paul, according to which we take you in. Non ut hospitem et advinam. Huh? Not as a guest and a stranger. Sed ut civem sanctorum et domesticum Dei. But as a citizen of the saints.
And the family of God.
And a household man of God. Gregorius Magnus et Sanctus Augustinus, Ceritus certe intuenter et benedico. Isn't that glorious?
They're looking down from the sky.
St. Gregory the Great and St. Augustine, certainly from heaven, are looking on and are blessing.
That's beautiful.
Well, certainly it is. We've lost everything.
Mm-hmm. Then, skipping a line or so, Paul the Sixth says that he touches on the more dramatic past, no?
Yeah, you have Aunt Felix here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this goes with something else.
Mm-hmm. Maybe from here, Ben.
I know.
From there.
This is a happy time.
In Latin, what does it say?
Atque Felix.
Atque Felix.
Si de preterita etate, diuturna et luctuosa recogitamus, cui id ut propositum est finem imponit.
If we are thinking over about past time, long and lamentable, to which that, as has been proposed, now places an end. He's talking about when went ahead this meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Got the idea?
The historical moment.
Certainly. Te in the moment of vide consideramus. We all together there?
Mm-hmm.
Then we consider the public importance. Quod hoc exemplum concordiae bene procedentes et hoc propositum mutuae opere. In re et usiver santis ad pacem inter nationes in mundo stabiliendam et ad Christianam inter homines proveendam fraternitatem possunt habere. The importance which this example of progressing agreement and this ideal of mutual cooperation Versantis. It's interesting. Finding itself in concrete reality and use.
Pragmatic.
Huh?
Pragmatic.
Okay, that's all right. But we can't say that. We can't talk that way in Latin. Are able to have for promoting, I see, for promoting peace among the nations. No, for stabilizing peace among the nations in the world and for promoting Christian fraternity among all people.
In the next paragraph, Paul VI goes on to speak about the ecumenical value of the meeting.
Occurrit praeterea momentum ecumenicum.
He says, furthermore, there comes to mind the ecumenical importance, huius congressionis, of this meeting.
Huius congressionis. Non latent nos questiones graves et implicate, quae exea oriuntur, et quae ut in presenti solvantur, non pertinet ad illam.
They do not escape us, namely, serious and complicated questions which come out of this meeting, you see, and which, in order that they may be solved in the present moment, doesn't belong to this meeting. We can solve this today. Sed nemite exhibentur, ut res primare nuce ponantur quae sunt semper quidem valde difficiles. But the same questions are presented in such a way that the primary questions are placed in clear light, which are indeed always very difficult. Does that make sense there? Are you following?
Yeah, yeah.
Et quae sic proferuntur, and which are expressed in such a way, ut simul in earum studium incumbamus, so that together we dedicate ourselves to the study of these questions. De iisque meditemur, iam sine ulla simultate, it's a very interesting word. I know who the Latinist was. It was Hamiletus Tondini. My father in the office. When he got sick, I took his job. Writes beautiful Latin. That we meditate about them without any rancor, simultate, without any dissent. Quam humanus superbia parit, which human
pride
produces. Et sine ulla suspicion in communo terreni, and without any suspicion of earthly gain, and that we do this according to the words of Christ and with the help of the Holy Spirit.
The last words, which you don't have there, he says, exultemus et latemur in ea.
Exultemus et latemur in ea.
Let us rejoice and be happy in it.
A huge thank you there to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, and he's the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury.
Laudator Jesus Christus.